We present My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schrein and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another sporting encounter between our teams of hand-picked sporting encounterers, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. We start, as usual, with an expedition into the remoter corners of the dictionary, in search, as always, of meaning. Frank, what's the meaning of febrifuge? F-E-B-R-I-F-U-G-E.
I've got a birthday coming up next year, which I don't particularly want to arrive at. And it's in February, so if I was a refugee from there... No, it's presumably from febrile,
yes,
which means...
Yes.
I hardly need to tell you, Doctor. Means feverish. And febrifuge is one of those things that, like aspirin and quinine and Dr. Collis Brown's chlorodine, which is supposed to lower your temperature and make you feel better.
I will give you 2 marks for that. I thought you were going to ask for one for your birthday, but no, 2 marks for driving the fever away. Antonia, Jeremiad, J-E-R-E-M-I-A-D.
Well, a Jeremiah is a long, long whinge, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the original long whinge by Jeremiah, who was the great whinger.
I once heard a doctor say that a patient of his had given him a Jeremiah of champagne, which I tried to work out what the patient was. Anyway, you get 2 marks. He got none. Dilys, what's the meaning of cumshaw? C-U-M-S-H-A-W.
I think that means backsheesh.
It is, yes.
Kind of tip.
A tip. Well tip. Done. A pourboire, a tip, or gratuity. Dennis, what's the meaning of titubation? T-I-T-U-B-A-T-I-O-N.
It's not another of your medical words. No.
Well, not really. Mm-hmm. It could
Somebody
be.
Somebody get from a tight bra.
I think that wins you a bonus mark.
It could be medical. That generally means it's something to do with something like psychiatry. In other words, something you don't really know.
I mean, medicine is to do with all life, really.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's to do with this behaviour. I'll give you a clue. The dictionary definition, the first line of it is the act of titubating.
Oh, that helps. Yeah. It sounds like it's a sort of a mixture of titillate and perturb. So it would be, if you're in a state where you are perturbed about being titillated, which is really the best word, that means guilt and steaminess, and it's the best kind of titillating. You're
I'm titubating a bit in the background.
He's miming playing the oboe.
Shivering and jumping.
Shivering, jumping, quivering.
Exactly.
Being in a state.
Fidgety. Fidgetiness, it is. We'll give you the marks for that between you. You got it. Especially fidgeting caused by nervous irritation, it says here. Actually, the dictionary definition is rather nice because it was written quite a long time ago, and it says, to stagger, reel, totter, stumble, to rock and roll. Anyway, 2 marks for Dennis. Now, before we go on to the next round, here are Frank and Dennis are the quotations you were given for the last round. And Frank's is Alice in Wonderland, and Dennis is A Stitch in Time Saves Nine, one of my mother's favourite sayings, it used to be. And meanwhile, a round from which our question setter, Peter Moore, describes rather jauntily as an assortment of sundries. Frank, what is the connection between a free pass to the theatre and the late Mrs. Phoebe Ann Butler?
In America, people who sell passes and tickets and various loose tickets are called scalpers. Mm-hmm. And Phoebe Ann Butler was bald. He was completely bald, and notoriously bald. He often had photographs in the papers saying, "This is Phoebe Ann Butler, who's bald." So scalpers and the scalps were known as...
2 marks. Well done, Frank. 2 marks. Antonia, before we go on to Antonia, perhaps we ought to explain what the real meaning is there. We've given Frank the 2 marks. The real meaning is that a free pass in theatrical circles is known as an Annie Oakley.
Oh, that too, yes.
And Mrs. Butler's maiden name has been attached to that. Presumably, it says, because of the holes punched out of the ticket, which resemble those that she, as a markswoman, shot out of playing cards. And if you believe that... You believe anything. I think your explanation is much better.
But she went at her shooting bald-headed.
Antonia, were you to follow the advice given in Lady Gough's Book of Etiquette, published in the 1860s, how would you arrange the books on your bookshelves? It's difficult to... It was sort of a prurient age, it was.
Well, I suppose would I novels?
No, it was not to do more with the authors of the books than the substance thereof.
Well, I suppose titled folk would come first, naturally. But I didn't. You couldn't. That couldn't have been the answer.
It was to do with the mixing of the.
Oh, of course, yes. Now I know why Frank was making that funny face. I do this anyway in my own books, so I take it for granted. You mean that men and women were divided?
No.
Oh.
No. It was to do with marital status. It was that no book by a married male author was put next to one by an unmarried female author, nor one by an unmarried male author next to one by a married female author.
So you mean that my books, as I'm a married female author, would not be next to... Well, everybody here is married, so...
Jane
Austen.
Yes, well, Lady Gough obviously had something in mind at the time, but I think whatever it was, it's rather nasty. We'll give you your mark anyway for struggling, Antonia.
Thank you.
Dillis, apart from being difficult to say, what is noteworthy about the following sentence? Jackdaws love my big sphinx of quartz.
Jackdaws love
my big sphinx of quartz.
Oh, of quartz. Q-U-A-R-Z. That's one of those things about all the letters of the alphabet or something. It isn't a quotation from anybody. It isn't a statement by some proud...
Quartz owner.
or sculptor. It's the statement which has, I should think, all the letters of the alphabet, perhaps some of them twice.
Say no more, you get your 2 marks. Next time you go want to buy a typewriter, just rattle that off and you'll have tested everything.
Yes, naturally.
Well, 2 marks for Dillis. Dennis, in Japanese it's Koki Koko. In Spanish, it's Quiquiriqui. In Russian, it's Kukuriku. What is it in English?
I'm not sure. Frank and I once wrote a whole program about onomatopoeic words based on the thesis that foreigners have different words for sounds like bow wow and ding dong, and they're so different that foreigners don't just talk differently, they are built differently, because they cannot, you know, the noises that are actually made bear no resemblance to the sounds that foreigners give. And I forget which this quickwiriqui was. I shouldn't think that even a foreigner would say quickwiriqui is the sound of church bells. Would you?
I cheated a bit by making, but no, I made it, mm-hmm. I mean, I could make it more onomatopoeic.
Go on,
it could be, in Russia, it could be kukuriku.
Oh, come on, for a taxi. Is it cuckoo? Yes. Cuckoo.
No. It's a more early morning than.
Oh, is it cock-a-doodle-doo? Is it that?
Yes, it is cock-a-doodle-doo. How did you guess? 2 marks for Dennis. Now a round entitled "Who Is She?" Where we go back to our friendly poets, each of whom writes about a lady. Can you identify the lady and name the poet? Frank, your two lines from the centre of a little work are, "She whirled round and round till she sunk underground."
This is a fairly obscure poem. And it's about a... I mean, the whole point of the poem is this lady whirling dervish who crosses her legs one day before whirling and screws herself into the ground.
And she lived midway between where you and I live, as it happens.
Chertsey?
Yes.
Then the only notable poem that's come from Chertsey is The Curfew, isn't it? The Clappers.
There was an old lady...
I don't want that one.
Well, if you don't want it, you don't get any marks.
There was an old lady of Chertsey.
Yes.
Oh.
Have a go at the second one.
Well, it'd be curtsy, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And she done my own.
Who made a remarkable curtsy. She whirled round and round till she sunk underground. And it has a bathetic last line. Chertsey is repeated.
Oh, it's Lear, then.
Yes,
that silly old lady of Chertsey.
Yes. There was an old lady of Chertsey who made a remarkable curtsy. She whirled round and round till she sunk underground, which distressed all the people of Chertsey.
But the curfew must not ring tonight, as you've mentioned.
Anyway, we gave you a mark, didn't we, for Lear. Antonia. Her arms across her breast she lay. She was more fair than words can say.
Is it the Lady of Shalott?
No, but it's one of... she was related to the Lady of Shalott via the poet.
Ah, so it's Tennyson. Mm. And is it Maud? No.
No, nor the Miller's Daughter.
Or the Princess.
It's another lady. She's not...
Oh, La Belle Dame...
No.
Sans it.
That's not
one no, praised her ankles, one her eyes, one her dark hair, and lovesome mien. In robe and crown, the king stepped down to meet and greet her on her way. It is no wonder, said the lord, she is more beautiful than day.
The beggar maid.
And she'll be my queen.
Yes.
Said King Cophetua.
Cophetua. You never forget that name once you hear it.
Yes. Did that cause you trouble at school?
Yes.
King Cophetua. Yeah, it is. The beggar maid. Two marks, eventually. The Beggar Maid and Tennyson.
Awfully hard this week, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes. Well, we thought we'd tighten things up a little bit. We're running out of marks, you see. Dilys, for every time she shouted fire, they only answered, little liar.
It wasn't the one who said... Billy in one of his nice new sashes fell in the fire and burnt to ashes.
No.
It wasn't G.K.
Belloc.
It's Belloc. You get a mark for Belloc. And therefore, when her aunt returned, and the house were burned.
Is it Matilda?
It is. Yes. Matilda, who told lies and was burnt to death. Huh. Dennis, she found me roots of relish sweet and honey wild and manna dew.
That sounds like one of that Golden Treasury mob, doesn't it?
it's the one I foolishly mentioned.
La Belle Dame, is it?
La Belle Dame.
The one who led me to her elfin grot.
That's right. My son brought that home from school and read it out to me. Have you seen this? He read it in our poetry book. My elfin grot. And the poet?
Keats.
Well done. Two marks for Dennis. Now, a round of double definitions. One word, two different meanings, and I'm going to give you the definitions of each meaning. Give me the word. Frank. One meaning is a regular custom. Second meaning, a monastic attire.
To cope. habit.
Habit. Well done. Two marks for Frank. Antonia. A witch's attendant... One meaning, closely acquainted with, is the other meaning.
A familiar.
Well done. Two marks for Antonia. Dilys, a baby's comforter, and an imaginary card player who sits opposite the dealer.
No idea, you know.
Dummy.
Frank knows, and I will quote Frank. He says, dummy.
And Frank is right. Too much. Dennis, rounded pebbles and a 20s hairstyle.
Shingle.
Well done. Two marks to Dennis. And now we come to the Frank and Dennis's quotations. And Frank's is Alice in Wonderland.
I don't know who it is compiles those books of proverbs, English proverbs and things. You look up. But I've got a new one for them. If you know anybody who does it, just tell them to get on to me. You know, there's lovely, useful phrases that make life easier to live, such as never rest a warm baby on a cold slab. And always be kind to those people less fortunate than those who are more fortunate than the unfortunate people who are less fortunate than the fortunate ones who are more fortunate than they are. And I've got one which I really do think from experience would be very helpful in the future. And that is, if you're contemplating climbing up Mrs. Mumford and chewing the lobe of her ear, do ascertain what sort of earrings she's using, or you'll fall off Mrs. Mumford into the mashed potatoes. This could be very useful, because it actually happened, you see, in my household, this thing. But I'm running on ahead of myself, so I'll just dash forward and get myself back. It's really to do with our cats. I haven't discussed our animal position for some years now, and we have, in fact, a new youngish kitten, an ex-chap, called Chinto, named after the highest mountain in Corsica. He's a very clever cat. He's an Abyssinian. He's called Chinto, but we in our family don't call the animals by their names, and we don't call ourselves by our names. Now, what one goes is for some personal characteristic. Now, typing is only one of Chinto's extraordinary characteristics. He has two more very strong ones. One is he roams. He's a terrific wanderer. Off he goes. So we called him, what? Our wandering boy. The happy wanderer. There he comes, the happy wanderer. Look at him. And he disappears at night, and you have to go out at 1 o'clock in the morning with a flashlight. And there he is, stuffed down the toe of a Wellington, or behind the refrigerator. And this, sometimes we just take into calling him Wanda, although he's an ex-chap, as I said. We just call him Wanda. And one day last week, on a Thursday it was, Mrs. Mumford came. She makes loose covers for the furniture. And she's frightfully good, and she comes and sort of measures it up and snip, and then 10 days later you have this lovely great thing of yellow velvet or something which fits like a glove. And I had to see her because John Amos wants a new suit. and he asked me whether Mrs. Mumford would oblige. So I invited her to lunch. Now, the other characteristic of Wanda the cat was that he runs up people and sucks their earlobe. Now, this is the most extraordinary thing, but apparently quite a lot of cats do it. It's a sign of affection or something. Anybody here from Abyssinia? Well, I just wonder whether sort of Abyssinian people run up you and chew your earlobe as a sign of affection. But our cat does, and our happy wanderer does, and he sort of puts his arms around your neck and chews away at your earlobe, making sort of noises, which isn't bad, you know, if you're unless he's attached to your earlobe. And then the noise is 1/4 inch away from your eardrum. And it's like a recording of a lion devouring its prey. It's a terrible noise. Anyway, the point is, he ran up Mrs. Mumford at the lunch table. He ran up, fastened himself to her earlobe, and started chewing. Mrs. Mumford had earrings on. And whereas my wife has those little flat gold things, Mrs. Mumford had rather large ones, which were little gold sort of needly things in a kind of sunburst. And the wandering boy took one chew of this, gave a cry of rage, a squeal, and fell off Mrs. Mumford into the mashed potatoes. Which is why I have formulated this proverb, which I hope will go into the Oxford Book of Proverbs, which is, if you're contemplating climbing up Mrs. Mumford and chewing her earlobe, do ascertain what sort of earrings she's wearing, or you'll end up in the mashed potatoes. And my friends, that just isn't a proverb, because the cat's never done it again. So it's more than a proverb. It's, as Lewis Carroll would have said, a lesson the wander learned.
Thank you very much, Big Bean. I couldn't see that one coming. Now, Dennis, a stitch in time saves nine.
Ah, how that brings it all back. Paris in the 20s. And that glittering coterie of artists who used to foregather in the Brasserie Lip, celebrated cafe belonging to Henri Lip, the man who invented the stick that still bears his name to this day. Everybody would be there, not just Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Gertrude Stein and Picasso, but the lesser-known artists, like Jean-Louis Perrier, the struggling sculptor who carved life-size statues of French naval heroes out of cheese. Or Marcel Morceau, the alternative French mime artist, still recovering from the injuries he sustained while falling down an imaginary staircase. What did we talk about that winter, as I recall? The talk was all of Freud, which everybody knows is the French word for cold. And because it was so bitterly Freud, everybody was telling their landlord that the show must go on. Show being the equally familiar French word for heat. But besides that, our talk would be of art and love and about Georges Seurat, the founder of pointillist painting, and how he'd been abandoned by his Italian mistress with the heartless words, "Che sera, sera, sera." Or how Paris's largest collection of Impressionist painters was being acquired by a certain adorable demi-mondaine because, so the dealers whispered, she gives you amour for your money. But what joy it was to be alive then. Even half alive was good, because we sat round the zinc-top tables, zinc, as everybody knows, being French for five, sipping small cups of coffee and discussing the great questions of the universe, like what do French restaurants do with frogs' arms? And we would occupy ourselves with such matters while sipping great steaming bowls of that savory potato soup the French call vicious swash. But always the talk would return to us, whose star was rising on the artistic horizon, whose was setting. Would the next literary lion be the new convict playwright, Jump Bail Sartre, with his daring verse drama dedicated to two French sailors, Sailor V and Sailor Gare? Or would tomorrow's artistic frontiers be defined by the moody young Australian, Earl's Court Fitzgerald, a tormented youth who was unable to decide whether to be a writer or a painter? So he'd just written an 80,000-word novel on a canvas with a brush. And, of course, the other topic that occupied us foreigners was how to support ourselves in this exciting but unfeeling city. And nowhere was this more pitifully true than in the case of the young writer who was then known affectionately as our Gert, later, of course, to become more widely known under her full name, Gertrude Stein, She was, of course, a distinguished poet who was to bitterly denounce the French policeman with her verse, "A rosa is a rosa is a rosa." But at that period of her career, she was having a very thin time, being obliged to support herself and her flatmate, the celebrated striptease dancer Alice B. Topless, by taking such precarious jobs as dog walking, door-to-door flagstaff selling, even a spell at the Folies Bergères, cutting the holes in their fishnet tights. But when even those humiliating positions had petered out, when she was really on what I'm sure her admirers won't mind me calling her uppers, suddenly came news that a post had been found for her as foreign correspondent for one of America's most prestigious news magazines. And that line which prompted this memoir brought that whole happy time back, Paris, the 20s, and the fortunate post on a news magazine that salvaged our Gert's sagging fortunes. How did it go again? Ah, yes. A niche in time saves Stein.
Thank you, Dennis, for that memoir of an exciting age. And I see from the score sheet it's Antonia and Dennis's turn to be over the moon, and Dillis and Frank's turn to be as thick as a budgerigar. And until our next programme, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Pete Atkin.